This is Perspectives, the show where a conversation about our differences shows us how much we have in common. I'm Candace Presley. My guest today is Dr. Catherine Meeks. Dr. Meeks is the executive director of the Absalon Jones Episcopal Center for Racial Healing.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to do this work.
Well, let me just start at the beginning. I grew up in Arkansas with an illiterate sharecropping father and a mother who graduated from college the same year that I graduated from high school. And I came to understand during my 18 years of growing up in Arkansas that there was some constraints for me as a young Black person in terms of what I could dream and what was expected of me and how what I was supposed to become. And I resisted all of that. I thought, I'm here, I'm creative, I'm smart, and I want to be this person that can do whatever I want. And I set about to do that and get on that path. And I have spent my whole life working to be a free person and working to be a free woman and thinking that it's my responsibility as a free woman to try to help other people be free. So that's got me from Arkansas to age 74 in Atlanta, still doing this work with great joy and thanksgiving. I'm thankful to God to be at this place, to have, you know, I have a PhD from Emory. I could be sitting around writing books and talking about lofty ideas, but I prefer to be talking about lofty ideas that might lead to real liberation.
And the work that you're doing, Catherine, is truly in the trenches. I know there are a number of activities that the organization has been engaged in since the recent protest in our city on June 29th, or May 29th, that is.
Yes. Well, we because of the virus, we had to close our doors and come to work at home. And I wasn't sure what that was going to be like to work at home, trying to run a center from your computer. But it turns out that you can do an awful lot in terms of webinars, and you can actually reach more people this way. So we have reached thousands of people, to tell you the truth, in the last few weeks with our webinars. We did a series on lament because I believe that there's a lot of grieving going on around the COVID virus, and then layered on top of these police killings and the injuries and killings that have happened as a result of people being out protesting. So we've done a series on lament, and now we're doing a series on reimagining policing, because I believe so strongly that we can't reform policing. We have to reimagine it. We have to come up with a new way to do public safety. And so I want to lead a conversation, not only in locally and in our church, but across the whole country about this, so that we can start thinking of a new way to do that work. So we're in the midst of doing that reimagining of policing series right now on the webinars. And if people are interested in knowing about them, they can go to our website at Center for Racial Healing and register to participate.
And I think you've got one more coming up in addition to the policing.
Well, after that one, I'm doing a series of facilitated conversations with all of the Episcopal bishops in the Southeast. It's called Province 4, but it's like all of the Southern states, which makes up Province 4. And so what I want these folks to do is to go on record as leaders in the church saying, we stand with doing this work of reimagining policing. We need religious leaders to really step up to the plate and to really say, this is what the church is about. We're about trying to do work that can actually lead to saving lives. And we have got to turn that corner, I think. And we've been too comfortable with putting Band-Aids on cancers. And I really think that we need to get down to doing surgery.
As you facilitate these conversations and you talk about reimagining what policing looks like in our communities, how do you bridge the gap between the community that says very strongly, we back the blue, and the community that says very strongly, stop killing us?
Well, you know, I hope we can learn to stand somewhere, get somewhere in the middle. Well, we don't have to be anti-blue people in order to want them to act right. And so I think that we've got to figure out, one of the big things we've got to figure out is how to talk to each other and how to really listen to what one another is saying. We can't have police officers grounded in racist narratives coming into Black and brown neighborhoods and acting out of those spaces without there being some way to moderate some of that stuff. And we can't have communities that aren't protected. And so if you are in a, like the system we've got now is so out of control, and I think we've got to all stop and take a deep breath and say, what do we really want? And we all want to be safe, and we want everybody to go home at night, both people that break the law and people that are trying to enforce the law. There needs to be an atmosphere where that work can be done without somebody having to end up dead. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that part, at least. But I think we get way into trouble when we start trying to figure out how to get there. So that's why we're starting with, we have police officers and civilians on these webinars that we're doing. We're getting ready to start working on organizing conversations between community people and police officers. We have got to see each other as human beings that are worthy. And we have got to work on changing the narrative that the police officers are working out of, and the narratives in the community that's based on fact. The police do not happen to be our friend right now. I mean, you cannot call a police officer into a Black or brown community and be assured that somebody will end up dead. And so it makes you think maybe you shouldn't call the police. But we need to get past that to some place where I would think I could call a police officer and they could come and do the work that needs to be done, and everybody could go home safely afterwards. And we've got to create something else. And that's what I'm just like this evangelist about, because I think we can't afford to keep having people killed, and these community polarization doesn't work. You know, you get people polarized on both sides of issues, or three or four sides, and then everybody just stands around and throws stones at each other, and you end up at the end of the day with a whole lot of injured people and no solutions. And so our center is taking up this initiative of reimagining policing and creating spaces for communication across all kinds of stripes. I mean, we got to listen to folks we don't want to hear, and we've got to learn how to figure out, well, what is good for the whole? Can we not just think about ourselves individually all the time and think about the larger community? And, you know, it's hard. I get it. And none of this is lost on me. I have two sons, so I worry like everybody else and grieve about every day. I can't get my mind off of these young people that have been killed. And that keeps pushing me toward, that's why we got to learn how to do this differently.
When did you have the talk with your sons?
Oh my goodness. Since they were little boys, you know, they're 34 and 39 now. And when they were little boys, you know, you do the drill of, this is how you mind yourself in this world, not only just with the police, but just in general, to talk about race. I mean, my children have been very conscious of the fact that we live in a society that's predicated upon white supremacy for a very long time. I was an African American studies professor for many years, and so they heard a lot of this, and they went to a lot of events where they heard these things. But when they started driving, that was the most frightening time. And I think now, you know, I hate to say this, at 74, with them in their 30s, the other day I was wishing that they were 8 years old again, because then they would be with me everywhere they go. And I would know that I would be there to be the intermediary between things. And I thought, you know, you got to do better than that. They're 34 and they're 39. They're not going to be young again. But there's just that kind of, you don't ever get over it. You know, the sense of, I just want them to be safe. And they know that. And since they were teenagers, that's been the up at the front of the coin. I remember my youngest son wanting to go to North Georgia with a bunch of white people and nobody else. And I said, no, you're not going to North Georgia mountains by yourself with a bunch of white people. And he was so upset because he just didn't think that should be a problem. But then he finally just said, Well, Mama, I guess I'll just have to listen to you. And I thought, yeah, you do, because I'm still the mama here. And your staying alive is more important than anything else to me. So, you know, we've been talking about the security of surviving in a racist society for a very long time.
When you talk about surviving in a racist society, and you know that there are people in our community who don't believe that this is a racist society, mm-hmm. how do you answer those questions?
Well, you know, if I don't know how they come to that conclusion if they pay attention to anything. I think that white people don't have to know how things are because they can stay in the bubble of the world that's been made for them. And so it's difficult sometimes to, I do a lot of training around race, so it's difficult to be patient with that, you know, well, I don't have privilege and I've worked hard, and if black and brown people just do what they need to do, everything will be fine. That's just too reductionistic, and it's not true. And then the other day, I actually heard somebody black say they hadn't experienced racism, you know. So I don't quite know what to say to a black person who says that. I do know what to say to a white person, because I think that you're living in your privilege, and you don't have to get out of it unless something happens to push you out of it. And that's pretty much what I say. You can have that opinion because you don't have to ever deal with what it's like to be followed in a store, or worry about your son being murdered by the police, or be not having a chance to have a job interview because your last name doesn't sound right. Those are not things that you ever have to worry about. And so you can afford to stay in this bubble. And I'm pretty straightforward about that. I mean, I don't go around beating people over the head with sledgehammers, but I'm certainly not ready to be apologetic about what I understand the truth to be. And I do understand that white people can deal with this with race when and where they choose. And when they don't choose to, they don't have to. And it's important for us people of color to make it clear to white folks who want to argue with us about whether racism exists, that they can have those thoughts and opinions, and because they don't ever have to really see life as we see it. And one of my major things to say to people is that if you want to respect me at all, you have to respect my story about my experience in this world. You know, if I tell you that I've been treated in these ways, then if you respect me, you have to respect that story and not try to explain it away by telling me, oh, well, you must be mistaken. That wasn't racism. They were just doing blah, blah, blah. Or that's happened to me and 10 other people. I mean, everybody, you and I'm sure everybody listening have had those experiences where you tell somebody white something that was really a racist thing that happened to you, and then they want to explain it for you. I don't let people do that. You don't get to edit my story, and I won't edit yours either. I mean, I respect your story. I might tell you that my reality is very different from yours and ask you to pay attention to that. So, and it's tiring too, you know, to kind of have to live in that space where you're conscious and you're running into unconsciousness, and you're always trying to kind of judge how much do I want to enter into this conversation. And some days you don't want to because you're just tired of it. But I do a whole lot of entering into it because I think you whittle away at racism and you destabilize it every time you do a little chiseling on it.
You've been leading these conversations, Catherine Meeks, about racial healing and reconciliation. Share with us how those are going and how do you approach that?
Well, we do dismantling racism workshops in the Episcopal Church as a requirement for anybody who wants to be a leader. And we have people who come into those rooms wanting to learn, and we have people who come into those rooms not wanting to learn. They're there because they want to be a leader and they have to take the workshop. And so we're pretty unapologetic in our approach. I say that our Center for Racial Healing is a brave space where the truth can be told, and where we will tell the truth. And that's my approach to doing the racial healing work. We're telling the truth. And one of the major questions you have to answer for yourself is, do you want to be well? Because if you're walking around harboring racist, supremacist thoughts and thinking you're superior to somebody, you cannot be a well person. And if you're a Black or a brown person that's sort of eaten up with internalized depression, you can't be well either. And so then it's not really about what you're going to do for me or somebody else. It's what you're going to do for yourself. Do you want to get well? And that's the approach, you know, do you want to be well? And think about it. It's got something to do with you. It's not just about you trying to say, well, it's not about trying to learn to be politically correct or culturally competent. It's about, do you want to be well? And a person who goes around projecting other people into being less than them cannot be a well person and is not going to be. And we say that in kind and loving ways, but unapologetically.
How confident are you that this isn't just a moment in time and it will go back to the way things have always been? Are you confident that real change is about to happen?
No. Because we have seen too many starts and stops. But what I am confident about is that I've not ever seen the whole world standing up with us at the same time saying racism is a bad thing, even in, you know, out their own environments and in your environment in the United States. I think that whether we see sustainable change depends upon people like me and you doing our work in a way that says we're not going backwards. I think it also depends upon religious communities taking a stand to try to really live into what they claim to believe. So that's one really, really big place where we can move down a different road if we really choose to, and really think about doing things that can be sustainable, really deconstructing some of the systems that exist in this country that make it possible for folks to keep on practicing racism. Now, if we do some of that, things will be some different. So that's why I actually think that the reimagining policing could be one of the ways to do something that will be sustainable. That worries me that we would work our way back to normal, you know, and when I'm preaching that there is no normal to get back to. And I want to help be a disturber so that people won't think that you can get back to normal. We're not going to get back to anything. We need to get forward to whatever is the next thing.
Well, Catherine Meeks, COVID-19 and the racial injustice demonstrations that we've seen in recent weeks, certainly like you, are disruptors. Mm-hmm. How do you recommend that like-minded people who want to see substantive change, who perhaps don't look like you or me, when they get in a room where there is no one like you or me in the room, mm-hmm. to have those conversations, how do you coach them? What do you tell white people to say to each other?
The main thing is to tell the truth. The main thing is to be honest. The main thing is to decide what about your privilege and white skin supremacy notions you're willing to let go of in order for justice to happen. And I think that people have to make those decisions somewhere, probably by themselves in some deep reflection. And then when they're in the rooms that are all white or in the board meetings or the corporate headquarters or whatever, they will be committed to telling the truth. So I think that the first thing that white folks who want to be allies to Black and brown people have to do is to decide if they really want to resist oppression. I mean, you got to make a decision somewhere inside yourself that's the path you want to be on. And then you'll have the courage to speak up when you're just in the room by yourself and you don't have to do grandstanding or something just because somebody of color happens to be around. It's about integrity and being honest. But that's not something that happens in the moment. It's something you've thought about and you've made a decision to be that way. I mean, I am a resister of oppression. That is what I do. I resist it everywhere, all the time, every day. I don't care who's talking or what they're talking about. And I think that that's what I teach. That's what we say at the center. And that's what I say to one white person or 50 white people. You have to find something in the core of yourself that pushes you toward wanting to stand for liberation and justice and equality, because it's how you make yourself a well person too.
What is the hardest thing for you about doing this work in this space, especially in the nonprofit space?
The hardest thing is going in a room full of white people and starting at step one. I know that I can make a difference by the end of the day, but I know that it's a rough journey getting from starting to the end of the day, and I don't like that.
How do our listeners and our viewers who might want to do work with you, have you come out and talk to their group, their organization? How do they contact you guys?
The Center for Racial Healing website, it's just Center for Racial Healing, and you'll be on our website, and my email address is there. People can email me, cmeeks@episcopalatlanta.org, and we're really good about staying responding to people, and I would be very honored. We're on Facebook. They can find the Absalom Jones Center page or Dr. Meeks's public page. So if you search around on Facebook, you'll find me in the center, and then of course our website. And I would be delighted. I'm delighted to always talk to anybody who's really trying to do something to help change the narrative.
One other thing I wanted to ask you, Dr. Meeks, and Dr. King said it many, many years ago, that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning tends to be the most segregated hour in America. Do you see that changing?
No, I don't. Because
not ever?
People, well, maybe, you know, maybe, I don't know. Not in the next long span, because people are just so set in doing what's comfortable. And so we still have so many churches that are either Latino or Asian or white or African-American or Caribbean or African or whatever. And I think it's such a misunderstanding of what the body of Christ is supposed to be. And the Episcopal Church is a white church outside of in the United States. You get outside of the United States, it's not a white church. But we have got to always be pushing against that. We've got to be saying, there's one, God's family is one family, and we need to learn how to live in it. And it doesn't really matter whether you're Christian or not Christian, it's still God only made human beings, and it's one family. And so I'm always lobbying for that, but I just think that it's gonna be a long time before we go into a place where you just everybody's going to church, you know. We've got all of our particular ways of doing everything, and nobody wants to change anything, and nobody wants to really learn or be challenged in any kind of way. So we just like to go sit in the comfort seat. And so I think that makes us be a long ways away from the 11 o'clock not being segregated. But we're gonna have to desegregate some of those other hours. And if we desegregate them enough, eventually people maybe will think that they can sit in the church house together. I hope so. I don't expect to see it in my lifetime.
Dr. Meeks, is there anything else that you wanted to make sure that you shared with our audience today?
Well, I just want to say that I think everybody has to take personal responsibility to be a resistor of oppression and projecting negative stuff about people you don't know out, instead of trying to learn about people. And at Black, white, brown, we need to try to stop a minute and think about other people as we think about ourselves. I mean, there's that lovely notion that we should love our neighbor as ourselves. And we will be willing to say that a lot. But when it gets down to practice, we just act like we never heard of it. And I really think that we could make that as a personal decision, a personal pledge to ourselves. And it can make a huge difference and just moving forward.
Dr. Catherine Meeks, we appreciate your time. We appreciate you sharing with us again today. And we look forward to talking to you at some point in the future. I certainly hope we can call on you again when we need you.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Perspectives is a community and public affairs program crafted with you in mind. If there's a guest you'd like to hear interviewed or a perspective you think should be explored, let me know. If you're old school, just write me, 1601 West Peachtree Street, Northeast, Atlanta, Georgia, 30309. Or message me via social media. I'm Condice Presley on Facebook, Condo29 on Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Be sure to listen again next week at this very same time as we examine another perspective.